Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
Hey.
Hey, Alex. How are you?
Good. I just had to switch devices because my permissions on one of them doesn't allow microphone access. How are y'all doing?
I am good. Really excited to have this discussion with you. I see we have Nick was able to join. Should I invite him up as a speaker?
Yeah. Definitely.
Oh, not this Nick, but also, yeah.
Nick, how are you? Welcome, Nick. Okay, well, let's begin. Actually, let's hold off a minute, and we'll begin shortly. Just wait for a few more people to join.
All right, I think this thing works.
Yep, we hear you.
Howdy ho, everyone. Okay, I was on Edge Network before, and I don't think I was, like, hearing you guys properly, but I should be a little bit better now.
Yeah, I hear you, Claire.
Has anyone tested out Spaces from the desktop yet?
Nope.
I've listened to it on the desktop, but I haven't seen an option to use a microphone.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself either, but I do remember, like, seeing tweets that, oh, it's announced, oh, it's released. Maybe we just haven't, like, gotten access yet or something.
Yeah, I was just talking with Nick about how I have to set up BlueStacks on my computer to try and run Spaces off of there, and that might work.
Interesting. Is that like a workaround, or is that like just a required plugin?
It's like a program that emulates mobile apps on your computer, so you can have the same permissions as if you're using a mobile app instead of like a web app.
That's cool. Okay, let's begin. Today we're here all gathered to talk about Bitcoin mining with the Kaboomerangs team. We have Alex and Nick, as well as we have Nick Calabro, a Bitcoin founder startup. And we're going to talk about Bitcoin miners, the network hash rate, what's new, what's going on. Hopefully you find this conversation interesting, learn something new. I know I will. And let's begin. So everyone, I think everyone's aware, but maybe not. We've recently reached an all-time high of network hash rate. I believe it was on October 12th. We reached 457 exahash, which is mind-boggling how fast we're growing. And I don't think there's any end in sight. Alex, I know it's very hard, not hard, it's just impossible to know where this mining hash rate's coming from. But do you have any insights into where, what parts of the world or this might be coming from?
I mean, I think like there's a ton of growth happening in Russia, in the Russian market. One thing that we've seen is like some of the people we work with in China have been a lot more aggressive with publishing stuff for the Russian market specifically. And that's been kind of like a newer thing that I've seen a little bit more recently. But I just think globally, you know, people are interested. I've seen a lot of growing interest in South America and Central America. I know Paraguay is kind of like a hot spot right now, but Venezuela has a ton of hash rate and is continuing to grow, even if it's, you know, not always legal to do so there. And then other countries in South America. But I just think that, you know, people are understanding the value proposition of Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining specifically. And it's just getting deployed everywhere. I mean, just anywhere there's power generation, there's an opportunity to mine Bitcoin. And miners are just moving around all over the place. But yeah.
Is it, do we know, like you just mentioned, you know, these different areas, Russia, do we know this based off information the mining pools released? Like, how do you know this? Like, are there any real indicators like that are certain other than companies, let's say, raising money or, you know, infrastructure being built?
I just see that it's like really difficult to get any like real hard data in this industry. I think the mining pools have a lot of data. You know, people like Foreman have a ton of data, but they'd probably take a credibility hit if they were to publish a lot of it, because not everybody wants data about them shared publicly, even if it's just kind of generalized. But I'm just kind of gauging based on what I'm seeing based on individuals operating in China that sell a large amount of equipment. But yeah, the United States is still a huge market and is growing, you know, pretty rapidly here as well. I forgot to mention that, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that from the actual network, there's no real way to determine where the hash rate's coming from other than somebody disclosing it.
Yeah, I mean, you can try and estimate, but I personally don't know, you know, how to figure that out. But, you know, we hear all these different metrics periodically. I was looking at something yesterday that said like 20% of global hash rate is still in China, despite it being illegal there. And I'm not really sure where that number comes from, but I think that's an interesting estimation or metric to look at.
Pools would have the ability to geolocate IP addresses, but, you know, that could be obfuscated or not reported or just inaccurate. So, I mean, it would be kind of hard to identify where every single hash comes from.
Right.
I guess there's also, can you follow the energy, right? Like somewhere at some point there's a plant or someone who's like pushing out more power, unless you have an anonymous source of energy, I guess, like, and you have a volcano, for example, then you're like purely off the grid, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. Right. But anything, let's say coal or solar, that's all going to require infrastructure investment, which is noticeable. Well, I guess even a volcano would require some sort of infrastructure. But yeah, I guess on the ground, there's always indicators. But as far as the network, I don't think there is other than the IP that Nick mentioned.
You'd have to have some kind of mechanism to accurately survey. And we can estimate. But, you know, similarly to how we don't really know how many people are on Earth, we don't know how much power is used on Earth. So it wouldn't be super reasonable to think that we could track, you know, every kilowatt hour that gets consumed on Bitcoin mining either.
That's a fair point. I want to start talking about the Bitcoin miners. I don't know if they don't think that many people are aware that Bitcoin miners, the machines, you know, it began with people using their computers at home and evolved into these specialized computers, ASICs, that mine Bitcoin, just Bitcoin. And recently Antminer revealed the new Antminer S21. And I'd like to look into these. I'm curious to hear what you guys think of them. I know they're still being talked about. They haven't released them. But when you guys heard this news, what were you thinking? Were you thinking, I got to save up to buy some of these and hold off on buying some of the older machines? How did you think about these new machines coming onto the market? And to point out, these machines are extremely efficient, right? They have approximately 200 terahash output with 3,500 watt energy usage. So that's 17.5 joule to terahash efficiency. That's the energy divided by the terahash. So I'm curious, you know, and compared to the current machines, the XPs or the 120 Pros, how are you thinking about these new machines?
Well, just like any new release, you know, you have to kind of think about are the published metrics going to be accurate? Are they going to deliver on time? Are they going to deliver at spec? Are they going to have delays or manufacturing issues? Or by the time they get around to shipping, are we going to be in some international conflict that affects the supply chain? Those are all very possible issues. And so, yes, we're interested in moving S21s. And I think it makes a lot of sense for people to be deploying S21s next year. But I wouldn't put all your chips on one model, regardless of what the model it is.
Right. And then you run into this new machine could have new issues that we haven't experienced before. And then you're waiting for parts and then you're offline. So diversification is very important when you're looking at models. That's a really good point.
And there's probably a likelihood that that Bitmain will slightly tweak the machine. It'll be a little bit different than a S19. It'll have a different power supply. And so sometimes those replacement parts in the beginning won't be readily available. But yeah, I mean, I was like super, super excited about the published specs of the S21 when I first saw it. And I think the timing is really interesting with them potentially being delivered right before the halving on the first batch. But there's just a lot of risk involved with taking that pre-order that Nick highlighted. And like one of the things that I found pretty interesting too recently is there's been stories going around about Bitmain making decisions with employees to try and save some money. And so, which signifies that they might not be doing the best financially. I think they're probably fine, but that's like a whole nother risk factor to throw into the equation that might mess up the timeline of delivery if you even get the delivery period. But yeah.
That's news to me. I did not know that there's rumors of financial challenges in the organization. I mean, they're the leading ASIC manufacturer. If they go down, that's going to shake the market.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're going to go down. And I think, you know, based on what I've heard from people that are kind of like work closely with Bitmain, is that it's not as bad as it looks on its face, but still it's not really like a vote of confidence. But I mean, one of the biggest issues too is the machines are likely not going to be deployed until after the halving. And so if you tie up all this capital in S21 pre-orders right now, there's an opportunity cost of Bitcoin that you could have mined with K Pros or other units that you could purchase now.
Yeah. opportunity cost. Definitely have to take that into account. Speaking of the halving, how would you, I mean, you know, obviously it's anyone's guess, but as you know, as we know, there's the cycles and they're marked by the Bitcoin halving. With these new machines coming online, do you have, and then with, you know, with the halving and it becoming less profitable to mine, but then again, you have more mature mining industry, do you have in mind some sort of target network hash rate that we're going to see after the mining? I know it'll be temporary. Well, once the Bitcoin price rebounds, or you know, when the next bull run, more people will start mining again. But during that time, where after the halving, if we're not profitable, do you have any ideas of how long that period can go on for? I know it's like a really speculative answer that I'm looking for, but just curious.
Well, I'm pretty much betting on the idea that we're going to see a blow off top cycle like we had before. But there definitely is the potential that Bitcoin continues to stay flat. I think one of the most interesting things about, you know, this bear market, we just watch hash rate continue to explode. I think people are finding alternate ways to monetize mining. Like one of the big ones that people are focusing on right now, which is super interesting, is demand response. But, you know, then there's a bunch of, you know, hosting customers that, you know, oftentimes don't really care if they're mining at a loss because they're using that as a tax opportunity to accrue expenses. But yeah, as far as target hash rate, I don't really have one. I just know that it'll go up. Like I've been telling people that they should plan for, you know, just maximum pain and make decisions based off of that. But it'll probably be better than what they expect.
Plan for the worst and hope for the best. What was that you mentioned? You're seeing a trend. I wasn't familiar with that. Something about reward.
People are finding ways to make money outside of just like explicitly the mining rewards. So they're getting paid to turn off their machines at opportune times. To assist like the people producing the electricity, they're finding ways to, you know, leverage the tax system or, you know, other things like that to make it economically viable. Because like sometimes it's economically viable to just lose money doing something because it's, you can write it off as a tax expense and get a break on that.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that in Texas and elsewhere where it's being used to stabilize the grid. So you're getting paid more to turn off your machines than you would to actually be mining Bitcoin. And obviously, that's a good deal. A tax benefit that I think you're maybe referring to, but maybe there's another one that I'm not aware of. But the equipment that you buy, these machines, they're considered equipment, which it can be written off as an expense year one, 80% through bonus depreciation. So I've heard some people that, you know, they had a big tax liability and they bought a bunch of machines to generate that phantom loss to offset their taxable income. And then, you know, and then you have these machines, which, you know, you could use. That's also another revenue stream. And Nick, this is something more up your alley. We saw in the last couple of months, Ordinals was creating an additional revenue stream for miners. From what I understand lately, it's been dying out. I saw Trevor on X say that Ordinals is dead. Is that so? What's going on with Ordinals?
I think the calling it out as dead is almost like baity, right? Kind of just like, probably nothing, like that type of thing. I guess it works. I mean, it got you to bring it up. I mean, it's a little, it's a little bit deader for me these days. I'm much more fascinated just in, I don't know, like over the last couple of months, I've all chains, all coins and everything. I've kind of, really consolidated down to pure Bitcoin. It is so fascinating to me. I mean, you're right. That's like you have like this massive rig in Texas and like it's more valuable because someone's subsidizing it to turn it off. It does kind of remind me of that, right? It kind of reminds me of like similarly, like when you're like running political elections, like they're always like you have like the GOTV, the get out the vote. But like in some circumstances, you're actually best off not getting out the vote and you don't want people to vote because they're not the right people to be voting. So it's like there's always like a balance of like someone shorting the other side of it. I mean, it gets me thinking, like, what the heck kind of environment would we be in where like enough municipalities like in Texas trying to balance the grid, having miners turn off, would that actually impact like the difficulty level or something, right? Like you can actually almost ban things together. I mean, I guess China literally kind of gave us that example by banning the whole thing. Either way, I'm kind of just going on a tangent here because I found that piece like really, really fascinating. And as far as, I mean, I guess this, I would love to hear what the Kaboomrax guys feels about ordinals and everything, and especially like BIP 300, 301. I mean, these are supposedly all kind of avenues for everyone to make more money, right? Especially if we're, you know, using the main chain. I find like a weird kind of duality of like Bitcoin maxis are typically the ones that are like against it, but at the same time, they're also recognizing that like there's money to be made. So I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to like totally circle it back here, but I would love to hear what you guys think about ordinals and BIP 300, all these other side avenues of like making money rather than the asset itself.
Yeah, I'll jump on BIP 300 first. I think BIP 300 is not really worth spending a whole lot of time on because it's contentious. It requires a fork, and so therefore it won't ever happen. But yeah, I mean, the discussion of like side chains and stuff like that is pretty interesting. But yeah, there's going to be, you know, attempts to essentially, you know, replicate what Paul's trying to do there and, you know, create these side chains that operate differently. And it'll bring up the transaction volume on the main chain. Ordinals, I'm kind of indifferent on. I see like the value proposition at some point, but I don't really understand like the why it was such a huge deal. But it is nice to have increased mining income. But I just think like, you know, we're gonna see mining revenue go down for in the near future, you know, regardless of what happens, and then it's going to go up as the price appreciates. But yeah, Nick, I don't know if you have thoughts on either of those topics.
So like, I don't know enough about ordinals to say anything intelligent about it. It's just another NFT system, you know, but whatever. For me, anything that increases fees is great. So if you want to put pictures of Barbie dolls on the blockchain, be my guest. Please pay a high fee. I don't really care about all that. Just don't mess with my Bitcoin and increase the fees, please.
Yeah, I guess that's one thing that's really interesting about ordinals is that it brought up, you know, this question of like how do we operate and use Bitcoin in a super high fee market, and to some degree it breaks a lot of the tools that we have, and just the ways that we've been thinking about Bitcoin and how to use it for a while. And like one of the most prominent examples was that Moon Wallet like ceased to function because of the fees jumping up so high. And you know, I just think like a lot of like on-chain services that people are using for small amounts of Bitcoin become kind of untenable, and we have to look at, you know, other options. Like I really struggle to see people using Samurai's services in a super high fee market for,
you know, smaller transactions like they do right now. And so that it's going to require the change of entire business models. I think that's really interesting. I think, you know, ultimately what it shows is it might not be a result of Ordinal specifically spiking the fees, but it's inevitable that's going to happen. That's going to become more of what the miner's income is versus just the block subsidy.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I always found the congestion on Bitcoin to be a positive thing, although, like you mentioned, it interrupted some businesses because the fees went so high, but it pushed users to the Lightning Network, or it made everyone aware of the Lightning Network, of how, like, we need this, similar to how layer twos on Ethereum did a similar thing where, you know, it became too expensive to operate on the mainnet. So I think temporarily it's annoying. But like Nick said, as long as you don't touch my Bitcoin, I don't care. And the increased revenues that miners are getting are great. And like Alex said, as the base reward keeps going down over time after each halving, these are the fees that we're going to need to sustain the Bitcoin network. These are the fees that are going to pay miners. So I see it as inevitable, and it's just going to continue, whether it's Ordinals, whether it's BitEVM. I don't know. Did you guys see that BitEVM? I think Nick, you saw that. How does BitEVM line up to these side chains and things like that?
That's a great question. I honestly wish I had a good answer for you. I feel like there were like four or five things all launched like in like a span of like 2 months. It was like you couldn't keep up there for a minute. I mean, from what I understand, it's definitely supposed to be really, really fascinating. I mean, they're saying that it can compute anything on Bitcoin, which is, I guess, kind of like the dream, right? I mean, it's literally the Bitcoin virtual machine, right? I mean, this is like the main computer in the sky if it actually works that way. But apparently it's like, you know, still super primitive. I don't think there's any use cases for it yet. Or I mean, I guess people can speculate on use cases, but I don't think it's even working yet or anything in practice. If you follow like Super Testnet, I see that he's like posting some of his code snippets and stuff like that, trying to build out projects with it. But I mean, it's still so early. It's like one of those things where like even Ordinals felt like at least it could like pick up traction immediately because there was something to play with. This doesn't even have that yet. You know what I mean? So it's like tough to even project what the heck this is going to do.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Maybe we'll have to do a space in a few weeks about EVM as it evolves.
But I guess there is like, I guess ultimately though, it's like usage on Bitcoin, and that's supposed to be, you know, I remember there were a ton of memes when Ordinals kind of first launched, and everyone was saying like, oh, this is how we solve the security budget. Oh, this fixes the security budget. Oh, this security budget, this security budget, that. And I'm like, my biggest worry with all these other little things, and like Ordinals especially, and then everything else kind of just like similarly, it's almost like I would see the congestion and like the high mining fees and everything, and like my main thing was, this is great, it's a cool trend, but like let's just not get comfortable thinking that like this is the new norm, almost like the anti-Ordinal argument, right? Like if this does not stick, and I think we're more, I think you can err on the side of it not sticking, because like Bitcoin kind of has like this nature of like forcing efficiency out of people, right? And like it's just everyone will go broke if they continue paying exorbitant fees to move a Satoshi, you know what I mean? So it's almost like, and that on top of, I mean, in the terms of, in the argument for Ordinals, just like the Satoshi itself is at some point going to be worth more than the freaking picture that's on it, right? So like that's also, I mean, that's a little bit more down the line, I suppose, but yeah, all these like things that like ultimately don't make sense. So it's almost like Bitcoin corrects for it sooner. Yeah, I don't know. There's like some interesting, but my main thing was like, this is great that miners are making all the money, but like, it's just not going to last. And I don't know. I mean, from the mining perspective, I wonder if it's like Ordinals was maybe just like a fun ride and like a little bit extra money was made. If it does stick though, then I guess to really keep up with Bitcoin, you're best off I mean, I guess this just kind of goes into like mining models and everything, but I guess investing all back into equipment to kind of stay on top of the trend then if it continues. But then you're, I don't know, do you end up maybe like losing out later on if, you know, you maybe like overextended relying on Ordinals revenue and then Ordinals dies. Meanwhile, you're still a Bitcoin miner, but like optimized for the wrong things. I don't know. I'm kind of like meandering here a little bit, but just some interesting thoughts that I've been kind of thinking about here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to take a quick pause just to do a shameless plug for all the speakers here. I'm Arya Monk, the co-founder of Onchain Accounting. We provide Web3 companies with accounting for their crypto transactions, accounting for their regular transactions. We offer fractional CFO services and crypto reconciliation and taxes. We have Alex and Nick from Kaboomerax. Great guys. I've spoken to them offline about mining. They sell miners. They host miners. They know everything about miners. If you're looking to mine Bitcoin, reach out to them. And we have Nick Calabro, Bitcoin startup growth. If you're looking to grow your Bitcoin startup, reach out to him. Very, very talented individual. And let us get back into Bitcoin mining. Question for the speakers, for the Kaboom guys. The biggest mining pools, right? The biggest one is Foundry USA. They have 30%. Then we have Ant Pool, which is at 22.5%. We have F2 Pool, which is 14%. And then it just goes down to Via, BTC, Binance Pool, 7.9%. And then we have a bunch of smaller ones. What are their risks? Let's say, for example, there's a pool called Brains Pool, right? 1.24%. What are the risks of joining, or are there any risks of joining a Brains Pool, which is 1.24% of the whole mining network hash rate? Or is there only a risk if you're talking about like fractional percentages?
You mean risk as far as not getting funds from the pool, not getting paid for your hash rate, or
what, yeah, what risk? Okay. Yeah, risk as in you participated in the pool and you didn't get the rewards that should have been allocated to you because you're part of a pool that's so small and they don't win blocks, they don't build blocks that often.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of risks that need to be taken into account when you're choosing your pool. There's different payout structures. So like Brains uses a payout structure called PPLNS, which is kind of like luck based. So you get paid out depending on how many blocks they mine and you know, how much hash rate you had online when the block was mined. So that's kind of like an important thing to know. If you're mining in a situation where you're curtailing a lot, it doesn't make sense to use a payout structure like that versus something like I'm forgetting all the acronyms, but
there's PPS. PPS, yeah. PPLNS, there's FPPS.
Yeah. Go yeah, ahead, so I've been I like Brains a lot, and I had, you know, traditionally done most of my mining with them, but there, you know, was a stretch where it wasn't hitting very many blocks and they lost a good amount of their hash rate, and I at that point I chose to switch, but I mean there's like a lot of reasons to mine with a pool, and what it oftentimes comes down to is the services outside and just specifically, you know, the rural rewards they offer. And so like one of the big selling points for Brains is being able to use their aftermarket firmware without a dev fee, or without the pool fee. So they essentially cut you a deal if you mine with them. And so you get to use increased efficiency, but you know, in a scenario like that, like anytime you're using somebody's software, like there's a risk. You know, you're giving up a lot of like data, to the pool, you're giving up data to the firmware providers, you're giving, If you're using management software, you're essentially, you know, giving somebody else the keys to your mine. And so it's important, you know, to find different ways to audit. You know, but one of the things you said is there could be a discrepancy on work that you put forward and the payout that is actually given to you. And that's something that's like always, always important to be auditing. And I know there's tools out there like Foreman is something that they advertise, gives you ability to audit your rewards. I think Linkcoin Pool is working on something similar for their management software. But as much transparency as the pool is willing to provide, or the more transparency, the better, as far as like their payout structure and how they're calculating things, is great. But there's a bunch of different pools out there. Like my strategy has been to try and promote smaller pools, you know, to promote, you know, decentralization, because I think pools like have a big threat or a big threat vector for the network in general, not just for you as an operator. But yeah,
I think you have to think of a pool as it's kind of like your employer. You know, you're providing work for them every day, and they're trying to provide you back with a benefit. And you know, just like your employer, you should audit the output. You know, make sure that your pay stub is what you expected it to be, and so on. And similarly, you know, they're your customer. Just like if you were a freelancer or something, the pool's your customer, and you could actually provide bad hash rate to them. And, you know, that used to be a greater concern in the past. And, you know, pools just kind of have to account for it. And, you know, that some of that's part of their fee structure sometimes. And different pools have different payout methods, whether, you know, like Linkcoin Pool offers, what's the thing, Alex, the payout mechanism that rides along Lightning? I don't know what it's called.
No, it has nothing to do with Lightning. It's called, yeah, it's
Paynim. I thought that was related to Lightning. I could be mistaken. But things, you know, different payment methods are interesting as well. There's a lot of small pools that can pay you in shitcoins. There's pools that will pay you with an ACH to your bank. So depending on what you're doing and how you're doing, you know, you should pick your employer or your pool that way.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So like, for example, I have a friend who has a off-grid solar setup that he mines, and he consumes the excess electricity mined off of his or that generated by his panels. And I convinced him to get off a Brains pool recently just because of this payout structure and to move to Linkcoin. And his income increased dramatically because he didn't realize like that you don't get paid when you curtail and have no hash rate on Brains pool. So there's like a lot of different reasons to mine with different pools. Like another attractive thing about Linkcoin is their management software. But, you know, if somebody develops their own management software, which, you know, Nick has done in the past himself, there's not as much an incentive to like go after that feature, and you might look at, you know, a different pool for a different reason.
Well, you have to think a pool like Linkcoin Pool, and I don't know the specifics of what Linkcoin's doing, but a pool like Linkcoin Pool, if they're paying you PPS, and they're paying you the same for those shares, whether or not you're intermittent or not, or have good uptime. Again, the pool's your customer. And so if you're providing them lopsided hash rate, where it's only on for 4 hours a day, you're not as valuable as someone who's on 24/7. And I would imagine if their average customer provides low value hash rate in that way. You know, their pay structure might have to be adjusted to account for that customer.
Do you know the market share of Linkcoin?
Oh, it's tiny. It's a very minuscule pool right now, which is part of the reason why I like them.
But that commentary would kind of apply to any PPS pool, right? Anyone that's not penalizing you for turning off your equipment probably has to build in some kind of additional margin to cover the variance that you're creating them.
Interesting. I wonder if variances from other miners cancel out others. Is Linkcoin, I was going to ask you, you mentioned earlier, which pool do you mine with, or is Linkcoin the one that you recommend as a small miner to help distribute the network hash rate?
I mean, if you're like a small miner, it's really important to look at payout thresholds, because a lot of pools require you to accrue a certain amount of income, whether it's like 1,000,000 sats or, you know, so there's some sort of minimum threshold like that to be able to withdraw off the platform. And sometimes you can withdraw if you pay like a fee. But that's something you have to look at if you're just like a guy heating your house with an S9. And so I think the solution to that, which is, you know, something I'm going to do this year, is to use a pool like NiceHash, and they allow for Lightning payouts. And so that 2,000 sats that I earn a day from heating my house with an S9, I'll actually be able to use, versus like if I were to use a pool, I think Linkcoin is like 100,000 sats. And I think Brains is about 1,000,000, but I think Brains is lowering that threshold. So those are things you have to consider that are not issues. Those types of thresholds are not issues if you're a larger miner, because you could be, you know, hitting that threshold every, you know, few hours potentially or less.
Right. Or you can always just lower the frequency that you withdraw Bitcoin. Obviously, you want to self-custody it, or you might want to sell it to fund your electricity. I use Luxor. I don't recall, I don't believe, but maybe I'm mistaken, that there's a threshold. At least it doesn't interfere with my frequency. And I don't believe I'm either charged for the network fees. I think they cover it.
Yeah.
But I
think choosing a pool, there's a lot of political components as well. You know, if you're a corporation and you want to mine at a U.S.-based pool that's following certain U.S. laws, you know, I believe a lot of large customers are using, you know, Foundry. Those are examples of, like, that pairs well. If you're a European and you want some non-KYC Bitcoin, you might mine to an anonymous wallet to NiceHash. If you don't mind KYC, you know, you might mine directly to, like, I believe Binance has a pool, and maybe you want to go do some day trading or something with that revenue. So there's a lot of buyers of hash rate, and again, the politics of each organization can be kind of complex. You could also solo mine. There's also pools that allow you to kind of, it's not really solo mining, but it's solo mining in the terms of when you get rewards. You're still using their infrastructure and they're still taking a fee. So you're kind of reliant on them to stay afloat or there tomorrow. But yeah, I mean, there's just like a lot of different components there when it comes to the pay schedule, the politics, the geography, the KYC, there's a lot there.
Right. And going back to something we discussed just before, if someone's joining a pool, a very small pool, right? Like Alex said, it's better for the network if we have many pools with that are, you know, controlling 3 to 4% of the network hash rate, or, you know, not 30% like we see with Foundry, right? So if someone joins a pool and they only have 0.2%, right, 20 basis points of the whole of the network hash rate, how is it that that won't affect their mining rewards? Like, if you go to a small enough percent of the network, aren't you at risk of getting like lower rewards than you should be because of how small you are, and then the probability of winning those blocks become skewed?
Yeah, you can find examples of people that operate small pools talking about this challenge. I believe long ago I either participated in or overheard a conversation with the Luxor guys about how they had to maintain a reserve in case they didn't hit a block. Mm-hmm. So essentially they had to self-fund payouts to keep their air quote employees happy while their business was unprofitable. But with more hash rate, you know, you have the luck component to getting a block, and you'll get a block, and that kind of evens out. It does kind of create a scenario where there's like a minimum sized viable pool. And really, that kind of goes up and down on what that number should be, whether it's measured in mm-hmm. exahash, kilowatts, or miners. It kind of goes up and down on every parameter. Personally, like philosophically, I would prefer to see a lot of small pools struggle than one big pool dominate. But I don't know how many people want to be, you know, struggling just for philosophy. A lot of people don't. A lot of people just want their business to turn the key and go.
Yeah, it's a lot to ask for people to lose rewards just for the – I'm sure the people out there doing it. But I think another factor is also – what's your duration, right? If your duration's like 1 month versus 1 day, you better be in a bigger pool, unless, you know, it's structured in the back end and in a way to capture and even it out. But duration also plays a big factor.
Not so much, right? You can mine. One example is there's primarily a shitcoin pool. It's called Zerg Pool. And Alex knows that I've used them for a variety of different things in the past. I like that they're non-KYC. They really remind me of the pools that I used to use way back when. And they essentially have a PPS structure on some of the pools, and they never get blocks. Like, never. It's awful. But they're funding it, and they're paying the miners. And a lot of the pools do have published rates for their PPS. So you can compare, you know, one hash rate will generate X number of Bitcoin or X number of payout in whatever denomination from a variety of pools. And if it's PPS, like, it's not much risk to the user. And if you can compare two PPS pools side by side, as long as they're honest in those published rates, all the variance should be reflected in the pay rate, not really market circumstance, unless they go bankrupt while you're using them.
Mm-hmm. I see what you mean.
It could be really complicated to manage.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something you have to throw into your risk assessment too, if you're choosing a pool with a PPS payout method is, you know, there's the risk if the pool goes insolvent, or there's a higher risk than something based like PPLNS that the pool could go insolvent, that you might not get paid for a certain amount of work that you contributed. Like, this is like one of the greatest examples of like recent time of like a pool having issues and customers, just having issues with payouts was a pool, and because they got tied up in like all this yield offering nonsense with BlockFi and Celsius and those guys. and were unable to pay their customers for a little bit and were like paying out IOUs. But they were able to get things under wrap and get people paid eventually. But it is a risk that, you know, you assume and need to, you know, kind of look at the pool and evaluate what they're doing. And if they're like, I think one of the things that like makes an attractive pool is diversity of income. If they have other ways to generate income, other parts of the business, other services that, you know, provide a little bit more stability.
On the same thought, like you could say that that's a bad thing, right? If you were like a Bitcoin only maxi in your philosophy, having someone that's supporting a different coin that's not Bitcoin could be a new risk that you're not interested in taking on. Or if they were doing the pool-in, the yield thing, like you were describing, you know, that if someone brings on a new coin to a pool and they invest a significant amount of money into it, it could detract from your future earnings if the pool's unprofitable or the organization.
Yeah, I'm more so like talking about things that are like real services instead of like complicated, stupid financial products that'll eventually blow up like pool and head. But like management software is a good one. Firmware is a good one. You know, pool proxies, various tools like that that they can generate income off of, I think are great.
But that revenue is going towards the company, not necessarily the miners.
Right. But yeah. if the company's profitable, they have an opportunity to increase their pay rate to more than the block reward.
I see.
Right? If I wanted to be a very generous corporation and I was making all kinds of money, I could pay my miners more for no reason at all. Now, what's the probability of that happening? It's probably not very high, but it's possible.
Right. I think what's also really important, going back to the diversification and you know, transparency and the risks of miner pools, I think something that is really important, which keeps the industry in check, is that users, customers, as you call them, people mining Bitcoin, they have the ability to redirect their hash rate to any pool at any time without any, you know, gates or permission required. So, you know, everyone knows that, all the pools know that, and that's a risk that, you know, they have to work with and make sure their customers are happy, because if they're not, they can just jump ship.
Yeah, and different kinds of customers have different kinds of requirements. While some parties want certain user experience features and dark mode on their website, other users don't care at all, and they want to send you, you know, 25 exahash and just move on with it. They want the highest pay rate. You have to kind of pick who your miners will be when you're optimizing your product. If you want to focus on dark mode, you're going to get the people that want a dark mode UI. If you want someone that wants to be faxed a financial report, then you better have a fax line.
Right. That's a good point. We're heading towards the end of this discussion. I wanted to see if anyone in the audience had a question to ask our mining professionals. If somebody has a question, feel free to request to speak, and we'll do our best to answer. That being said, seems like everyone is good on the questions. Alex, Nick, any last thoughts you'd like to share on the state of the Bitcoin mining network, Bitcoin mining, and everything that falls under that umbrella?
I think I'm going to get a heater miner now after this.
Winter's coming. Got to stay warm.
It's like a great thing if you like want to irritate your like spouse or significant other and waste a lot of time tinkering.
Yeah, it's if I can plug somebody, we have
we sent off some miners to CryptoCloaks, and they have a 3D printed kit. So it's not profitable. You'll lose all your money, but it's a neat product. For a couple hundred.
Isn't CryptoCloaks? Didn't I see from CryptoCloaks they did like that massive write up on like they had it in the basement running the whole heat for the house, like ran through tubes and everything. That was Ari and I think we were discussing this a little bit the other day. Like that is totally the future. I mean, that was sick. And I think that one, I don't know, maybe it was still not profitable. Probably not, but I don't know. Better chances than a USB.
In today's market, there's no chance that an S9 is profitable at your house. There's just no chance. Maybe if you're running it next fall and Bitcoin's at $200,000, we can talk about it. But even then, probably not. If you purchase one of those from him, there's a kit and the instructions, and you can actually reduce some of that noise that Alex was talking about. So maybe you don't have to end your marriage in divorce. and you can have a quiet heater. It's still not cheap though. It's like $300 to $400 project, but it could be a fun project.
Or you can send him. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've tried a bunch of different things around my house and spent too much money in the process. But I think what I've resolved to do this year is get the quieter fans off of Amazon, the Noctua fans, and replace the fans on my S9 and just run it that way.
But electricity at home is so expensive. Like, what do you guys get? Where I am, it's like 15 cents.
Well, if you're using electric heating in your home, it's no difference.
Right.
So
assuming.
Yeah. So, the same number of BTUs is going to come out of a watt, no matter how you bring the watt into your home, as long as you're putting it into the atmosphere of your home.
But the heat output is comparable?
It's identical. If you had a 2 kilowatt heater and a 2 kilowatt miner, they should make the same amount of heat, except for the noise. I guess you could subtract the heat that you get in noise instead, but that's very little. So I would recommend that if you're heating electric at your home, to figure out how you can tolerate a miner. There's a variety of solutions. I'm just deaf. Like that's the way to go. Just run it normal.
I'd rather be noisy than freezing.
Right.
That's probably, I'll just put in a pair of earplugs, headphones.
Like I acknowledge that the MCF gas to heat my house is far cheaper than running the S9s or the S19s or just leaving a computer on. But I prefer to get what I would call the Bitcoin heating rebate from the pool, and pay my electric bill like I normally would and have a little extra Bitcoin.
Right. Why is that the heat output is the same? Like, is that, I don't know if it's like a dumb question, but is that like standard? Like, I mean, different machines provide different, they're designed differently to produce different things. Why is that the same? An electric heater and a Bitcoin miner. I mean,
in terms of output. So there'd be a lot of different ways to like score your efficiency, but like longevity and delivery of it. But really, like I think it's, what is it, 3.4 BTUs per hour per watt, regardless of the consumption. So if your phone screen's on, your phone heats up, and you're using X number of watts. If you applied the same watts to an ASIC chip, you would have the same amount of heat. Or if you applied it to a toaster, you'd have the same amount of heat. It might be delivered differently, but it would be the same amount of heat released in BTU to the atmosphere.
Interesting.
The caveat to that is instead of directly making heat with wires, like in a toaster or an electric furnace, you may be adding a fan and moving air. Those are additional costs of electricity that don't directly correlate to heat production, but it's negligible in the scheme of it.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, a way to, get around the noise issue is I would think to, just like you have a boiler in the basement, you have, in the basement, your miners, and then you have air ducts that push the hot air throughout the house, and you don't have to hear any of it.
Right. I mean, a topic could be like, I'm a big fan of just leaving the air conditioning system on or the air cycling system on in my house. And if I heat one room with a Bitcoin miner, I'm going to cycle the air throughout the house and heat the rest of the house. If you have a leaky house, it can be problematic trying to deliver the heat to the places you want it. That's why space heaters are a thing to begin with. Leaky houses and inadequate production of heat by your furnace system. Another thing to talk about with the heat efficiency in terms of like how that's scored. If you were to look at a traditional gas furnace, they have efficiency ratings. Say you're burning natural gas in your furnace. The way they score the efficiency on the sticker is by how hot the exhaust is that you send outside. So the cooler the exhaust, the more efficient it is, so that's the more heat transfer you get to the inside. So it's interesting to think about efficiency and BTUs, because it's very comparable with all electric devices across the board.
I did not know that. I'm gonna look into that.
If you haven't wasted a week on refrigeration and furnaces and ductwork, like, what are you doing?
I gotta get on it right away. Okay, very good. This is really interesting, really insightful conversation. Thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for our speakers here. Again, Alex and Nick are from Kaboomerax. Nick Calabro's a Bitcoin startup founder. My name is Arie. I run On-Chain Accounting. We provide startups with crypto accounting services. And that's about it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You got it.
Cheers.